Hello, everyone. You're listening to This American Podcast. I'm your host, Trevor Kinsey. Let's get started. So first and foremost, I'd like to thank those of you who took the time to listen to our inaugural episode, The Three Floors to Truth. This podcast is an evolution in process, and much as the world around us, the tone, the language, and even the production itself are in a dynamic state. In the spirit of Thomas Paine, I encourage those of you who listen to please submit your feedback and become active in our community of citizens so that one voice can become many. The goal of my efforts here isn't to simply report on the perspectives I've derived from evidence-based facts, but instead to inspire others to do the same in their approach towards information. As we continue to venture forward into the subjects of today, I ask that your curiosity carries beyond the boundaries of this podcast and into the affairs of the world we live in. Remember, question things, ask for proof, chase the evidence, discover fact, and form truth based on the pursuit of knowledge and good. So originally, we were going to cover identity politics here in America going into this November's silly season for midterm elections. But in light of recent events in Philadelphia and the attempted bombings, I wanted to shift gears to a more serious subject and one that seems to rekindle old debates that have been discussed until people are blue in the face. You know, for those of you who know me personally, you know that I've covered this topic before on Facebook, but today we're going to take a closer look at gun violence in America. Now, this won't be the first and only time that we cover this, as it's comprised of many multifaceted issues, and keep in mind this is only one perspective. But regardless where you stand on this politically, this is an issue that all Americans should be concerned with, and you need to put politics aside on this. For those of you who don't know or maybe don't follow news as closely, as of the recording of this episode on Saturday, October 27th, there was a mass casualty event at the Tree of Life Synagogue located in a quiet, traditionally Jewish neighborhood in Philadelphia. Reports are currently stating that 11 people have perished in the attack, with multiple injuries, including three of the responding officers to the scene. The 46-year-old gunman, Robert Bauer, surrendered after being shot by SWAT. Bauer was heavily armed with an assault rifle and multiple pistols recovered at the scene, and reportedly made anti-Semitic comments stating that he sought to kill as many Jews as possible. Now, this is nothing short of a tragedy, and you know, my heart goes out to the victims, their families, as well as the neighborhood of Squirrel Hill in Philadelphia. Your home, your community, your schools, your places of worship, these are places that we subconsciously recognize as places of safety. Most people don't go home or to church in fear. We go home to relax, to unwind. We go to worship to be inspired, to connect with a higher power, and to be part of a community of people we share similar beliefs with. While I know there's a lot of argument to be made against organized religion, and at its most elemental form, what organized religion is it's a community of shared beliefs. And it's safe to say that most of these places are ones which seek peace. When you start mingling religion with violence, that's where you end up in extremist territory. Certainly a topic for another time, but the point I'm trying to make is that by and large, people don't go back to their neighborhoods or to their place of worship in fear of being targets. And that's not the climate we should aim to have. There's a lot of the same questions that arise after an event like this, and the first one is why? And I'm going to briefly skip over this question, because when people have died, the immediate concern isn't necessarily the motive. You know, the concern is, what could we have done to prevent this? So let's work the problem backwards. Instead of starting off with the, you know, political stances on gun control and trying to translate the Second Amendment and more, I want to take a closer look at a mass casualty event, rewinding the events and dissecting some of the areas of intervention. You know, some of these details have broad strokes, but you can apply these theories almost universally to any mass casualty event. You know, having studied physical security both in my time in the military as well as working security myself, you know, there are some key insights here that I feel are easy for people to skip over in the name of political convenience. So let's start with the location of the attack. This is the first layer of physical security. And as I said, people want to feel safe. You know, this isn't a new concept, especially in the course of human history. In fact, it's the very reason we had castles. Castles were essentially the premier gated communities of medieval times, but more importantly, the castle provided layers of safety leading up to the keep, or the main building in the center of the castle. These protected the communities of laborers who were integral to the function of those castles, but also acted as strongholds of strategic value. Castles often had garrisons of either military or militia members whose duty it was to defend the castle and its inhabitants against those who sought to take the castle or harm those inside of it. The genius of a castle design was in its fortifications, which provided layers of security to those inside of it, and its ability to defend itself against attacks. A castle is what we would define as a hard target, because it wouldn't be easy to attack. You have a defensive presence and posture that deters any would-be attackers. And if security and safety is your goal, then you want to present places you want to keep safe as a hard target. Now, in the military, defensive posturing is critical to a strategy which not only deters attacks, but is able to intervene if an attack is made. These differences are called active and passive defenses. Using our castle analogy, passive defenses are your walls, your big heavy doors, your locks, your moat, because what castle is really complete without a moat? Your gates, all of these things are passive in nature, meaning that they act as defenses by themselves. You don't need to tell a wall, hey, prevent people from coming inside. You know, it's a wall. It's going to do that by itself, to the best of its abilities, right? Active defenses are defensive measures which require an action, right? So your active defenses may be your armed guards, your patrols, your hot boiling pitch and stones to throw at enemies trying to climb the walls. They're defenses which actively provide protection instead of passively. Now, the opposite of a hard target, of course, is a soft target. Soft targets have little to no defensibility, making them prime locations to attack, as there are limited measures that would prevent, hinder, or stop an attack from happening. However, to truly defend a place, you need to understand what the threat you're protecting against is. For example, you're not going to spend time focusing on how to prevent shark attacks in Nebraska. It's just not a valid threat. However, you might in California. So knowing your threat plays a vital role in developing defenses and prevention measures, especially after a recent attack. If we're going to develop defenses, we need to understand the threat a little bit better. So you have to put yourself, as horrible as this sounds, into the mind frame of someone who is attacking. And security experts do this all the time. So let's do this together as an exercise, right? Let's put everything that we just learned into action, and let's take a look at two of the most popular targets in recent times, schools and religious institutions. These are the epitome of soft targets. Most are labeled as gun-free zones, which might as well say, if you attack me, you'll have the advantage. We're going to talk about schools first, as they're some of the worst offenders when it comes to defensive practices and policy, and one of the easiest targets for would-be attackers. Let's start with the passive defenses. Most, if not all, schools have a relatively open campus design, or if they have passive defenses, they amount to, you know, control points of entry that require visitors to sign in. Rarely, however, do they have fences or walls that keep unwanted people out. Elementary schools probably have some of the best defenses in this regard, as we don't want just anyone interacting with our children. However, most high schools and colleges are especially vulnerable to this, as anyone can walk onto a campus and start hurting people until the police arrive. Other than that, there exist very few passive defenses designed to keep unwanted people out of schools. Looking at active defenses now, some schools have campus security or campus safety, right? These range from your unarmed, you know, detention Gestapo, whose primary duties are to make sure students aren't getting into trouble, to the much more rare armed campus police who work closely with law enforcement units and are able to respond to a wider variety of issues and emergencies. Another active system is through security policy. These are things like your campus lockdowns. And in theory, a lockdown can be very effective and a means of mitigating an attacker's access. However, it's very important that you understand that a poor lockdown strategy and training can actually cause more casualties in the event of an active shooter scenario. So during a lockdown, your goal should be to put as many layers of defense between you and the attacker. This means locked doors, walls, barricades, and other means of covering potential victims. Also, you want to spread people out. And what I mean by this is that you shouldn't collect people in one area if possible. So a great example of this, I was in a lockdown drill at a campus I'll refrain from naming. Our Student Veterans Center was located in the library on campus. From the outside, we had three layers of rooms and doors, which, if you were in the back room, was completely occluded from view and had no direct lines of fire into it. The would-be attacker would have had to breach three doors to get to us. However, staff had us evacuate this area into the center of the library, which had glass walls looking out onto the campus on the second floor. This effectively downgraded the layer of safety we had in our Veterans Center from three doors to one glass door, which accessed the entire library's main space. An attacker making his or her way into the library would have simply had to walk 25 feet into the space before arriving at a group of 50 students huddled under open desks. Now, this area had little to no cover for those staff and students, and I notified the college administration about the glaring errors in this policy, although I'm not sure they took any of it, which, you know, should be alarming to anyone when you have military veterans explaining why your safety procedures would cause more casualties. On a side note, if there are any teachers or administrators listening, I'd be happy to help any school with their security procedures to better protect you and your students. But moving on, let's take a closer look at more ways that we could improve the overall situation for schools. Upgrading and fortifying passive systems is an expensive prospect for most schools. In a perfect world, we'd redo the walls with reinforced concrete, we'd add bulletproof glass and doors, and we'd have control entry points and a well-trained group of armed security staff on duty during school hours. However, that's not a realistic expectation, considering budgetary constraints of most of these schools. Now, there's a lot of talk about arming teachers, and I'm going to be the first to tell you that's not a rational idea in practice. That's a utopian security concept at best. Teachers in America are underpaid enough as it is, and now you want to arm them and train them to use a firearm, but furthermore, and more importantly, you want them to act with enough skill and professionalism to utilize that firearm in a stressful shooting situation effectively enough to stop an armed threat? Okay, listen, folks, these aren't security, military, or police professionals we're talking about here. You know, they don't routinely have range time and practice tactical movements and eliminating threats. These are your son or daughter's third grade teacher, or your professors in women's studies. I'm sorry, but these aren't the performers you need them to be when it counts. If anything, you're putting students' lives at risk, resting on the hopes of amateurs to save them during their darkest hours while underpaying them. That's a misguided concept at best. That being said, we should have more effective training on active shooter scenarios in which staff are well-versed in their respective duties and responsibilities during an attack. That's a perfectly reasonable expectation to have. But that comes with a caveat. These policies and strategies and training need to be designed and carried out by security, military, or police professionals, not by your school administrators. Just as well, students should practice these drills more than once a quarter. Doing exercises once a month is not an unreasonable expectation to ask when dealing with the safety of our students. In the Navy, we practice damage control drills on our ship routinely, and while they were super annoying to do, we had complete confidence in our ability to handle situations to better ensure our survival at sea. The effectiveness of training can be noted with the valiant efforts by the crews of the USS Fitzgerald and the USS John McCain, whose collisions at sea could have resulted in much larger loss of life and injuries to Navy sailors. Both ships were able to return to port as a result. But as we know, schools aren't the only soft target. Religious institutions are also prime targets. They have even larger budget constraints than schools, and their designs often leave very few exits, leaving victims trapped inside with their attackers. It's a very grim scenario. Response times have a lot to do with the amount of casualties in these events. In fact, this has been studied by many law enforcement agencies, including by Ron Borsch, who's a manager and consultant trainer at Sealy Police Academy and Bedford PD. Borsch has developed a statistical model called the Stopwatch of Death based on the murder statistics drawn from mass shooter events since 1996. The calculation is based on the number of casualties, dead or wounded, divided by the time a shooter was active to give us a numerical value that represents the number of murder attempts made per minute. For example, the Virginia Tech shooting had 55 casualties over the course of 7 minutes, resulting in 7.9 murder attempts per minute. The Las Vegas shooting had 573 casualties across 15 minutes, resulting in 38.2 murder attempts per minute, and Columbine had a factor of only 2.1 murder attempts per minute, despite an active period of just under an hour. The National Sheriff's Association places the average active shooter scenario at 12.5 minutes, with police response time hovering around 18 minutes. That's a time deficit of 5.5 critical minutes. So when response times are a literal matter of life and death, how do we decrease that response time? Well, a question that's not really being asked is, who is responding? If it's only the police, then we're still plagued with that 18-minute problem. And the only way that that gets fixed is if we hire and train more police officers. So let's further clarify that question by saying, who can respond? And I think if that question was framed like that, you'd widen your available options in reducing that time frame. I've said this before on social media, but there are thousands of expertly trained and experienced military veterans looking for opportunities to employ their skills. Many would even volunteer their time to defend people at a church or at schools. People have this notion that adding an armed element to these places involves people wandering around with assault rifles while your kid plays in a sandbox. Well, in reality, it would probably more than likely be something that resembled an air marshal. Although, if I'm being honest, while the air marshal strategy would be the best way to not freak parents out, you're still presenting a soft target. So the way around this is through defensive posturing. If you're a bad guy and you know the place that you want to attack has, without question, an armed presence, you may very well think twice about attacking that place. You've now turned a soft target into a hard target. Now, there's a reason that you rarely see assaults on police stations and military bases. These are objectively hard targets where bad guys don't have the advantage. Employing one or more armed security contractors is easily less expensive than upgrading security infrastructure. On top of that, you have a security expert on staff who could actively evaluate security strategies, policy, and drills to ensure that in the event of an attack, that establishment has the best opportunity at preventing casualties. And I do believe that this is something that needs to be provided from the private sector in terms of talent pool. You know, we don't need to create another government agency for this. We have plenty of state and federal licensing agencies that do the background investigations necessary to license someone for this position. And if the government did want to step in and help, they could provide federal or state grant money for school security measures to help subsidize the cost of having armed security on campus. This is a perfectly reasonable solution. Your banks have armed security guards. Federal and state agencies generally have armed security. Tiffany's even has armed security. So you can't tell me that currency and diamonds are more important to protect than human lives, and that having armed security at our schools somehow hurts our students. Our youth deserve the best protection we can afford to give them. They deserve safety and stability while they grow and learn. Our teachers also deserve peace of mind knowing that their classroom is safe and that going to work isn't a risky proposition. You want to be a productive citizen? Here's what you should do. Write your representatives, go to school board meetings, demand armed security to secure the safety of our literal future. We're going to take a quick break, everyone. We'll be right back with more. Hey everyone, if you want to see more great content, I could use your support. This podcast is currently researched, recorded, produced, and managed by myself out of my own pocket. And I would love to put out higher quality material more frequently. To help pitch in, visit our Patreon at www.patreon.com/thisamericancrisis. Starting at as little as $5 a month or less than what you spend at Starbucks, you'll get access to exclusive digital content only available to my Patreon members, as well as a discounted rate to my masterclass series I'm aiming to release later this year. Your support will go towards improving the capabilities of my studio, enabling me to do on-site interviews, increase quality, and reduce post-production time significantly. Now, if you're not able to become a Patreon supporter today, the next best way to support This American Crisis is to share it with your friends and family. And of course, as always, thank you for being a listener. I couldn't do what I do without you. Welcome back to This American Crisis. I'm Trevor Kinsey, and we're continuing to break down the events around mass casualty events in reverse. We covered the target and explained the important differences between hard and soft targets, and we took a look at response times and how we can mitigate casualties with better security. So what's next? Let's talk about the suspect. Having a well-defended location, what can we do to intervene at the human level? And well, the dirty, ugly truth of the matter is not much. Taking a look at some of the details out of the Philadelphia case this evening, the shooter reportedly made anti-Semitic remarks on a social media site. Now, it's easy to armchair quarterback this and say, well, there's the proof, as the proverbial canary in the coal mine. However, it's not that simple. As we discussed in the first episode, law enforcement needs to know certain facts when intervening on a threat or a crime. They need to know the who, what, when, where, how, and the why can also help in certain situations. And as ugly and as objectively wrong as anti-Semitic and hate speech is, from a legal perspective, it is protected under our First Amendment. We have the freedom to hate whoever we want in this country. And while that sounds wrong in the context of someone who's killed 11 people, the issue is it's not illegal to hate a person and use hateful language against them. Yes, it's morally wrong and should not be tolerated by our society. However, it's not explicitly illegal by itself. So if you're a law enforcement officer and someone tells you that they know a white supremacist Nazi who's spewing hate speech, there's really not much they can do about that, as there hasn't been a crime committed or even a threat to evaluate. If you're to say that you knew a white supremacist who you saw leave the house with a duffel bag that appears to have weapons inside of it and you have concerns about public safety, well, that's enough to warrant further investigation. If you're wrong, then your white supremacist Nazi friend is inconvenienced by having been stopped and questioned by the police, but that's really the worst case scenario if you're wrong. If you're right and he's got 3 automatic weapons and 4 pipe bombs on him, well, that's a different scenario. Rarely is that ever the case, however. People who have formal involvement in hate groups known for violence or supporting violence are actively monitored by our intelligence communities. In fact, the number one domestic threat labeled by U.S. intelligence communities is that from militias who are not only well-armed, but well-trained in military tactics. Our last time we saw any real activity from militias was in 2014 during the Bundy standoff. Multiple heavily armed militias gathered on Cliven Bundy's ranch against the U.S. Bureau of Land Management and federal officers, which resulted in federal law enforcement retreating to avoid a firefight with militia members who had a tactical advantage over the occupying enforcement agents. However, when it comes to the activities outside of a formally organized group, it is nearly impossible for law enforcement agencies to predict the actions of law-abiding individuals prior to their attack. This isn't Minority Report, and Tom Cruise isn't going to save us from lone wolf attacks. That is the bitter reality of our circumstances, which is why preventative measures have to be taken through defensive strategies. The answer here isn't more laws. Murder is a federal crime, as is terrorism and hate crimes. This is common sense. If someone is seeking to do harm to another person or a group of people, human ingenuity will lead them to that end result. The weapon is just an instrument. A firearm, in a mechanical sense, is just a Rube Goldberg device designed to put holes in things from very far away. That being said, a firearm's effectiveness is limited to the operator's capabilities. And this is why so much time, effort, and money is spent on warfare training to increase the effectiveness of weapon systems downrange. However, a firearm isn't the only instrument that can be used in a mass casualty event. The Boston Marathon bombers used an improvised explosive device, or an IED, using a pressure cooker and homemade shrapnel. And for those of you who were alive in 1996 may remember the Centennial Olympic Park bombing, where a pipe bomb killed one person and injured 111 people. And of course, we had the bombings from the Unabomber, as well as the most recent mail bombing attempts out of New York and Florida. So again, the instruments to carry out violence aren't just limited to firearms. And honestly, I find it naive to think that firearms are the cause of violence. Firearms require an operator. A bomb requires a maker. A bladed weapon needs somebody to wield it. So the common denominator for violence isn't the weapon chosen, but the reliability on a human with evil intentions. There are actually plenty of other countries who exercise their right to bear arms and do so more than the United States, who don't experience the same levels of violence as we do. Let's take Switzerland, for example. The last mass shooting they had was 17 years ago in 2001, and as recently as 2016, they only had 47 attempted homicides using firearms with a population of over 8 million people. In fact, in 2007, the Small Arms Survey found that Switzerland had the third highest ratio of firearms per 100 residents. More importantly, however, they are a culture which values weapons training. Additionally, teenagers all over Switzerland compete annually using Swiss Army service rifles in a test of accuracy, of which a king or queen marksman is crowned winner. Switzerland also has mandatory conscription for all military-aged males, which further increases working knowledge and respect of firearms in their culture. However, they have restrictive laws which prevent the purchase of firearms by unfit people. Those convicted of any crimes or have alcohol or drug dependencies aren't allowed to purchase firearms. Furthermore, anyone who expresses a violent or dangerous attitude isn't permitted to own a gun. Those Swiss citizens who want to carry weapons for defensive purposes must prove they can properly load, unload, and shoot their weapon, and are required to pass a licensing test in order to be permitted. And that being said, it is illegal to carry a gun in the street unless you are a police officer or security worker. And even then, carried weapons cannot be loaded to prevent them from accidental discharges. Now, the majority of US gun owners are law-abiding citizens who share similar philosophies to the Swiss with regards to practicing gun safety and a culture of responsible ownership. Most concealed carry weapon permits require the demonstration of these safety skills as well. However, what's critically absent from gun control in our country is an emphasis on mental fitness. And in legal terms, anyone with diminished responsibility can obtain a firearm. Now, what is diminished responsibility? In criminal defense, this term is used to excuse full criminal liability under the pretense that their mental faculties were diminished or impaired before or during the act in question. Now, it should also be noted that diminished responsibility or diminished capacity is a guilty plea versus not guilty by reason of insanity. But remember this term, as its definitions are important when discussing mental health and mass casualty events, especially as it pertains to the mental fitness of acquiring firearms. We could dedicate an entire episode to mental health in America, but I really want to focus on the underlying cause of violence and these events around the mentally ill. That's not a scapegoat or excuse for why certain attacks occurred or some plot to distract from other motives. That's simply a matter of fact. You can still have politically motivated attacks and have a suspect who is mentally ill. I wanted to walk through an example of this, though, and why taking mental health seriously needs to be considered as a measure of prevention. Going back as recently as February this year, we had the Parkland shooting, and in 7 minutes, Nicholas Cruz killed 17 people, injured another 17, bringing the total casualty number to 34, an attempted murder rate of about 4.9 people per minute, or about 1.5 times that of Columbine. Now, this next part's important because there were plenty of signs that were otherwise ignored by plenty of people who could have arguably done more to intervene and even prevent the shooting from ever occurring. Now, Nicholas Cruz and his younger brother were adopted by Roger and Linda Cruz, and in 1996, Roger passed away, leaving Linda to raise the two boys alone. In 2008, when Cruz was only 10 years old, his mother had the police called to the house to help control her sons, and this would be the first of many calls over the next decade. Sheriffs were often called to break up fights between Cruz and his younger brother, and neighbors often recalled seeing police frequently at the Cruz residence. Some examples of calls include the following. In November of 2008, police responded to Cruz throwing rocks at juveniles. In 2013, deputies were called after Linda was thrown against the wall for taking away his Xbox. Later that year, deputies reported Cruz used a BB gun to shoot a chicken. In early 2016, police were called after a neighbor's son suggested Cruz, quote, planned to shoot up the school, unquote, after seeing a disturbing post on Instagram. At this time, deputies concluded Cruz owned knives and a BB gun. They passed this information on to the school resource officer at Stoneman Douglas High School. Of the 24 incidences local police responded to at the Cruz residence, 18 of them involved Nicholas directly, although none appeared to be arrestable under Florida law. In November of 2017, Linda passed away from complications from a flu. Cruz later lived briefly with a family friend, Roxanne Deschamps. In a call to 911, Cruz stated that he was involved in a fight with Deschamps' son and was kicked out of the house and discussed his mother's death with 911 operators. In a separate 911 call, Deschamps told dispatchers that she was afraid Cruz would return to her residence with a gun and that he demonstrated violent behavior in the past, stating, quote, he put the gun on the head of his brother, so it's not the first time, and he did that to his mom, so it's not the first time he's put a gun on somebody's head, unquote. No arrests were made after the event, and sheriff's deputies returned Cruz from a nearby park back to the Deschamps residence. Cruz was later expelled from Stoneman Douglas High School under disciplinary reasons, And in late 2016, Florida's Department of Children and Families became involved after Cruz began cutting himself and posting images of self-harm on Snapchat. According to reports made by the DCF, Cruz began harming himself after a relationship ended. The report also details a range of conditions that he was diagnosed with, including that of depression. The DCF concluded that he was, quote, not a risk to harm himself or others, unquote. In September of 2016, three separate people, a sheriff's deputy who worked as a resource officer at Stoneman Douglas, and two school resource counselors stated that Cruz should be committed for mental evaluation. Most students who interacted with Cruz during his time at Stoneman Douglas identified him as a bit of a loner. The FBI was also made aware of Cruz in September of 2017 after he left a YouTube comment that read, quote, I'm going to be a professional school shooter, unquote. The FBI then received a second tip in January of this year, 5 weeks prior to the attack, where the caller told FBI that Cruz had a, quote, desire to kill people, unquote, and that he was worried about, quote, the potential of conducting a school shooting, unquote. Days after the shooting, FBI stated that protocols were not followed and this information was not forwarded to the Miami field office. Now, this is an incredible timeline of events. And there's a very important chain of custody here. No less than four people made direct complaints to law enforcement agencies regarding the possibility of Cruz committing gun violence, and more yet, interacted with Cruz and noted a failing mental state for which they had readily recognized as a threat. As for how he obtained the weapons, well, both the long rifle and the pistol were purchased legally in 2017. As we know, law enforcement was very much involved with Nicholas Cruz growing up. However, Cruz was never arrested during this time. So with no criminal record to speak of, Cruz cleared an instant background check via the FBI criminal database. While federal law is designed to prevent those with diminished capacity from acquiring firearms, these databases are fragmented and rely heavily on reporting to the FBI from mental health practitioners, local law enforcement, and more. So the systems that we currently have aren't sufficient enough to actively screen against mental health issues due to lack of communication between law enforcement and health professionals. Adding additional legislation would only be helpful if they bridged the information gap from stakeholders to better enforce the laws we currently have. However, this system would do little to nothing to stop someone from obtaining a weapon prior to mental health becoming an issue, but only as a preventative measure against those currently going through treatment or those who have had a documented history of mental illness. Laws cannot prevent someone from obtaining a weapon illegally from a law-abiding gun owner or through other means. Keep in mind, criminal laws as a construct only function as measures of deterrence to keep order for law-abiding citizens and instruct punishments subscribed for the crimes if violated. Someone who doesn't hold value in human life likely has little respect for the laws at hand, if only to avoid attracting attention towards their more nefarious goals. So what are our solutions here? Well, better security for starters. We need to take physical security more seriously and invest in active defenses to harden soft targets as a means of both deterrence and threat mitigation. We need more efficient and detailed reporting. It's impossible for us to enforce current laws or prevent criminal or terrorist activities using incomplete or missing information. Mental health also needs to be a priority in this country. You can watch the full interrogation of Nicholas Cruz online. And while I have no remorse for his punishment or condone any of his actions, there's a very valid case to be made that he is a highly disturbed individual. And despite multiple warnings, mental health professionals should have intervened and possibly prevented the deaths of 17 people. We have a very unhealthy stigma against mental health in this country, and we view the mentally ill as there's something wrong with them, right? That they're unfit to be in our society. In fact, it's very easy to call somebody crazy, but that only furthers our stigma against mental health. No one wants to be viewed like they're crazy, like they don't belong, or that they're defective. You know, there are plenty of people around the world who have mental conditions and overcome them or even manage them through proper care and treatment. Mental illness is no different than any other sickness or disease that our bodies can have, and we should champion mental health as being just as important as physical health in our society. Of course, that's a topic for another time. Well, folks, we're out of time, but I wanted to thank you for listening to another episode of This American Crisis. Again, be sure to visit our Patreon at www.patreon.com/thisamericancrisis and share this with your friends and discuss. As per usual, feedback is always welcome. Again, I'm Trevor Kinsey. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you next episode.